Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We'll hear the inaugural lecture in the Phil and Ruth Sokoloff Lecture Series, co-sponsored by the UNO College of Arts and Sciences and the Jewish Federation of Omaha. The guest speaker will be Martin Indyk, former United States Ambassador to Israel and Vice President and Director of the Brookings Institution. He'll speak on the topic, The New Administration Making Peace in the Middle East. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, November 24, 2009, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the University of Nebraska at Omaha, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Guy Matalon, director of the Natan and Hannah Schwalb Center for Israel and Jewish Studies and the Jewish Federation of Omaha Professor of Judaic Studies in the Department of Philosophy and Religion at the University of Nebraska at Omaha.
Before introducing our distinguished guest, I would like to tell you what the Schwalb Center does. The mission of the Schwalb Center, as established by our founders, Nate and Hannah, is to provide opportunities for students and faculty, administrators, and community members to learn more about Israel and Judaism. The center provides classes in Israel and Jewish studies, travel scholarships for students to travel to Israel to study, provides for research grants for faculty interested in conducting research in Israel, and brings speakers and lecturers to the Omaha area. Tonight's lecture would not be possible without the dedication and support of the Sokoloff-Javits family. Their commitment to the Schwalb Center allows us to bring some of the world's best experts to our campus to talk about Israel, the peace process, and the Middle East. This lecture and other activities of the Schwalb Center require financial resources, administrative support, and a lot of hard work. I would like to thank both Nate and Hannah for their confidence in me and in my colleagues at UNO to bring their vision to life. The Schwalb Center will have an important impact on the students and faculty and members of the Greater Omaha community. I do want to acknowledge the assistance of the Chancellor, John Christensen, the Vice Chancellor, Terry Hines, the Dean of Arts and Sciences, Dave Booker, the Jewish Federation of Omaha, and I don't want to forget Mary Bernier and the wonderful staff at the University of Nebraska Foundation. I would also like to thank my assistant at the center, Crystal Whalens. I don't know if she's here tonight, but she said she has class, so she was really dedicated. And I want to thank her for all her hard work to make this lecture possible. Our speaker tonight, former Ambassador Martin Indyk, has a very impressive resume. He served as the United States Ambassador to Israel from 1995 to 1997 and again in 2000-2001. He also served as the Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs from 1997-2000 and is currently one of the important vice presidents of the Brookings Institute, and he serves as a director of the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institute. The ambassador, as I said, before entering government service, he served 8 years as the founding executive director for the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He has been an adjunct professor at Johns Hopkins University, the Dayan Center for Middle East Studies at Tel Aviv University, and the Department of Politics at Macquarie University in Sydney, Australia. Dr. Indyk has published widely on the U.S. policy towards Arab-Israeli peace process and the complex challenges of the Middle East. Martin Indyk, just so if you're interested, was born in London, England, and was raised and educated in Australia. He received a bachelor's in economics degree from Sydney University in 1972, a doctorate in international relations from Australian National University in 1977. He is a member of the Council of Foreign Relations in the American Academy of Diplomacy. He is also the chairman of International Council of the New Israel Fund, vice president of the American Friends of the Rabin Center, and serves on the boards of Freedom from Hunger, Lowy Institute for International Policy, and the Sydney University Graduate School of Government. So without further ado, please help me welcome our distinguished speaker, Ambassador Martin Indyk.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much, Guy, not just for your introduction, but for hosting me here at the University of Nebraska. I'm delighted to have the opportunity to address you. And the topic that Guy gave me to speak about was the Obama administration making peace in the Middle East. In that very long introduction, what Guy didn't tell you was that I've just published a book on the subject of peacemaking in the Middle East. It's called Innocent Abroad, an intimate account of American peace diplomacy in the Middle East. And because I was so actively involved in President Bill Clinton's efforts to try to achieve a comprehensive peace in the Middle East, I wrote this book about what happened in those 8 years in which I was his Middle East advisor at the National Security Council and then his ambassador in Israel and then Assistant Secretary of State for the Near East in the State Department, and basically was part of the team that tried and failed to make peace in the Middle East. And in this book, I tried to act as a kind of lantern on the stern of the Clinton administration, shining the light on our wake so as to provide some important lessons from that experience with failure for the next time an American president decided to set course for a comprehensive peace in the Middle East. There are a lot of lessons, but I want to just start by highlighting the principal ones because it becomes an important way of assessing just how the Obama administration is doing. The first lesson from the Clinton administration's experience was, as the President Clinton himself said, it's better to try and fail than not to try at all. Or as he said it more recently, I heard him talk about this just a week ago, it's always better to get caught trying. It's important to try because resolving the Arab-Israeli conflict is in America's national interest. It's a way of promoting peace and stability in a region of vital concern to the United States. It's a way of squaring our relationships, our friendships, and our alliances in the Arab world and our commitment to the survival and well-being of Israel. And by helping to ensure stability in the region, it's a way of ensuring the free flow of oil from the Middle East to the industries of the West and increasingly the East as well. George W. Bush, after Clinton's failure, reached the opposite conclusion. His view was it's better not to try at all than to try and fail. And that proved to be quite disastrous for the overall effort to try to resolve the Arab-Israeli conflict and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in particular. After 7 years of adopting that approach, Bush came around with his Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, to accepting that it was important for the United States to try to resolve the conflict and to establish an independent Palestinian state living alongside Israel. So even he came to recognize that first lesson, that it's important to try. The second lesson is about how the United States can best use its influence if the president decides that he wants to resolve the Arab-Israeli conflict. As a superpower with considerable influence in the Middle East, the United States can be most effective if it tries to shape the strategic context in which the leaders in the region have to make their decisions. If they feel more secure, particularly in terms of the support that they will get from the United States, then they're more likely to take risks for peace. than if they feel insecure and threatened and unsure of the support that the United States will provide them. Shaping the strategic context today is all about trying to create a zone of security in which Arabs and Israelis can try to resolve their differences. The big challenge to that comes from Iran and its proxies in the Arab-Israeli heartland, Hezbollah in Lebanon and Hamas in Gaza. And it's a threat that presents itself not just to Israel, but to Israel's Arab neighbors as well. It manifests itself in a number of dimensions. The most obvious one is Iran's ambitions to acquire nuclear weapons. That is a threat not just to Israel, but to the Arab states as well. Iran's support for Hamas and Hezbollah enables it to interfere in the most sensitive parts of the Arab world, Palestine and Lebanon. And when it does so as an Iranian, Persian, Shia state, seeking to exert its influence, even to establish its dominance in the Arab Sunni heartland. And that is simply unacceptable to the Arab leaders, each one of them Sunnis. And so today, shaping the strategic context amounts to the United States coming in and finding a way to work together with the Arabs and the Israelis, because they face a common threat, to in effect roll back Iran's influence in the region, curb its nuclear ambitions, and show that the way of peacemaking can triumph over the way of violence and terrorism and defiance of the international community and threats to destroy Israel, which is the way of Iran, Hamas, and Hezbollah. The other side of that lesson is that the United States needs to avoid getting sucked down into the swamp of the details. You see, when the United States as a superpower comes into the region with the intention to make peace, all of the leaders there begin to feel quite threatened by that. And their first response, Israeli or Arab leaders alike, is to try to find a way to level the playing field. I mean, imagine it. You've got this superpower with great influence that's coming in to actually try to change your world. The best thing you can do is to drag the United States down into the details of any particular negotiation, because at that level, whether it's Palestinians, Arabs, or Israelis, they understand the details much better than the United States does. So the converse of needing to shape the strategic context is to avoid the sucking sound. Because if we get sucked down into the details, then we're going to find ourselves really bogged down and unable to use the power of our the influence that comes from our power. The third lesson is that the environment on the ground has changed dramatically since the days that Bill Clinton tried to make peace. At the beginning of his administration, the Soviet Union had collapsed. Saddam Hussein's army had been defeated in Kuwait. And all of the Arab states were sitting at the negotiating table with Israel and the Palestinians as well. All of them were engaged in direct negotiations with Israel. The United States was the dominant power in the region. Those Arab states that would make war instead of making peace, no longer had a superpower patron. There was no longer the potential for an Eastern Front coalition. And Yitzhak Rabin had been elected in Israel with a mandate, as he told the president on his first visit, to take risks for peace. None of those circumstances adhere today. United States' influence has been badly tarnished as a result of the way that we fought the war in Iraq. Israelis and Palestinians have lost faith in each other, do not trust the intentions of the other. Palestinian institutions of governance were destroyed during the Intifada and are only now being built back up. And therefore, it's important to recognize that a great deal of damage has been done to the whole notion of peacemaking by the Intifada, Israel's reaction to that violence, and the neglect of the Bush administration. The fourth lesson is all about understanding history's tempo. The fact of the matter is that the breakthroughs to peace in the Middle East have only ever occurred when one or other leader, Arab or Israeli, had a sense of urgency. Sadat stood up and said he was ready to go to the ends of the earth, even to Jerusalem, because he feared that a failure to do so would lead to the toppling of his regime. King Hussein of Jordan stood up and said that he was ready to make peace with Israel because he feared that a failure to do so would mean that he would no longer have the protection of the United States and that that would jeopardize the survival of Jordan. Yasser Arafat accepted the Oslo Accords because he was completely down and out, rejected by the Gulf states because he had identified and supported Saddam Hussein after his invasion of Kuwait. His coffers were empty. He was in desperate condition when Yitzhak Rabin threw him a lifeline and he grabbed it. At the end of 1999, Hafez al-Assad, the president of Syria, after playing around with us for 7 years, in which three Israeli prime ministers, including the current one, Prime Minister Netanyahu, had promised that they would withdraw fully from the Golan Heights, and he kept on adding conditions and conditions and more conditions. At the end of 1999, he said, I want to finish it, I want to make peace, and I have only one condition, which is to do it quickly. It's that sense of urgency which makes all the difference for an American president who wants to make peace. But what matters here is that the leaders in the region have to have that sense of urgency. If it's only us that have a sense of urgency, if it's we're the only ones that really want it, we're bound to fail. And the final lesson is that it's very important to beware of the unintended consequences of American action. You see, the Middle East is an immensely complicated place. There are currents and undercurrents that we as Americans, as a distant power, have a great deal of difficulty comprehending, understanding, and in particular, calculating how those currents will affect the calculations of leaders in the region. We tend to assume that that every problem has a solution and that all we have to do is to apply our American way and that will somehow resolve it. Well, that's what we thought in the Clinton administration. We discovered the Middle East had something else in mind for us. And so it's very important for American presidents to stay flexible. and to try to imagine the unintended consequences of our actions and to be ready to deal with them when they come along. So, how is President Obama doing? Well, you'd have to say after almost 11 months of effort, not very well. In fact, if you were grading his performance, you'd have to give him an E for effort, but an F overall. It's still early days. You know, he still has at least 4 years. But it's clear that things are not going as he expected. Certainly, he learnt the first lesson, that it was important to try, even if you can't see how you're going to succeed. And he did, from his second day in office, declare that peacemaking in the Middle East would be his administration's priority, and he appointed a special envoy, George Mitchell, a man distinguished by his record not only in the Senate and his investigation of steroid drugs, but also in the Northern Ireland conflict, where through dogged determination he managed to bring off an accord. And so the Obama administration set as its objective an effort to achieve comprehensive peace starting at day one, much like Bill Clinton before him. The second lesson, I think he understood well too, which was that the most effective role he could play was to shape the strategic context. And he has focused on an effort to engage Iran with the purpose of curbing Iran's nuclear program, and at the same time trying to use a resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as a way to serve as a kind of glue that would take advantage of this common interest between the Arab states and Israel in countering Iran's influence in the region. And he's done well on that front in terms of putting the spotlight on Iran's nuclear program, working with the Russians to bring them on board to build, in effect, an international phalanx against Iran's nuclear program. He also understood that shaping the strategic context required him to reset America's relations with the people of the Arab world and the Muslim world beyond. And his Cairo speech was designed to do just that. And it was a very powerful speech in terms of its impact on the Arab and Muslim worlds. The purpose being to try to open the space for Arab leaders by having the support of their people for working with the United States. So, second lesson, I think he understood quite well too. But from the start, there was tension between the president's way of achieving his objective and his special envoy's way. You see, the president, I think, began by believing that he could fly high and fast, that he could move quickly to achieve a breakthrough. And essentially his concept was that he would get Netanyahu, Prime Minister of Israel, to freeze settlements, including natural growth, and he would get the King of Saudi Arabia to engage with him as his partner and with Israel in trying to achieve that breakthrough. say it was a high and fast approach to try to resolve the conflict. George Mitchell had a very different idea of what needed to be done. Yes, there had to be freeze on settlements, but his idea was to put together a package deal in which the Arab states would take steps of normalization to towards Israel in return for Israel restricting settlement activity. It was much more a low and slow approach to the problem. The Obama approach quickly foundered. Netanyahu came to town and said it would be very difficult to do a settlements freeze, including natural growth. But Netanyahu said, if you can get me Saudi Arabia, well, that'll be different. So the president then went off to Saudi Arabia and put the proposition to the king of Saudi Arabia. You, King Abdullah, have outlined this Arab peace initiative. Now I want you to work with me to implement it. And the king said, no, pure and simple, no. I don't trust the Israelis, I don't trust Netanyahu, and I certainly don't trust the Palestinians. I tried to reconcile Fatah and Hamas. They ignored me, and a plague on both their houses. I don't want to have anything to do with them. So the president's efforts came up short very quickly. George Mitchell's more cautious efforts to shape the environment to build some confidence between the parties was a very different approach. It was one in which he began a negotiation with the Israelis about what a settlements freeze would actually look like. And unfortunately, George Mitchell didn't hear that sucking sound because the Israelis very quickly got him into a negotiation about what the settlements freeze would actually look like. And first of all, building in Jerusalem was excluded from the deal. Secondly, there couldn't be a freeze, there could be a moratorium, that is a time-limited freeze. And there was a question, would it be for 3 months, 6 months, 10 months seems to be where they ended up. Third, construction that had already begun, the Netanyahu government insisted that they would have to complete that. Well, that was 3,500 building units. And then, for various political reasons, they had to add 450 new units. So in the end, it was a moratorium on all settlement activity in the West Bank, which, as Hillary Clinton said, was unprecedented. No Israeli government had agreed to that before. But it didn't include building in Jerusalem. And as I say, grandfathered in a whole lot of settlement activity that made a settlement moratorium look something like the opposite of a settlement moratorium. And on the other side, those Arab states who had been willing to engage with Mitchell on the idea of making reciprocal steps for an Israeli settlements freeze, like giving Israeli tourists visas to come visit the Gulf and Dubai, giving Israeli landing rights in countries in the Gulf, restoring their economic relations, participating in multilateral negotiations, a whole menu of things. Well, when the Saudis came out and said they don't want any part of this, those Arab states lost their cover for doing this. And so were no longer willing to do it. So they ended up with a package deal that wasn't really a package deal at all. And I think the worst part of this was that even though the administration was entering into this negotiation for something less than a settlements freeze, it took them a very long time to adjust their rhetoric. Settlements freeze, including natural growth, was what everybody thought the administration was trying to achieve. It was only in September when the president met with Abu Mazen and Bibi Netanyahu on the margins of the UN General Assembly that he used the word settlement restraint rather than settlement freeze. You probably don't even remember that that happened. It was just kind of slipped in there. But it was his way of adjusting down our objectives. Too little, too late. Because by then, Abu Mazen was already up in a tall tree saying, if the President of the United States is insisting on a settlements freeze, well, how can I accept less than that? Palestinians had never made a settlements freeze a condition for entering negotiations before, not Arafat, certainly. Now it had become a condition because we'd put it out there as an objective. And so when we shifted, he was left up there, out on a high limb. And the problems that we now faced was compounded by another factor, which was that the President of the United States found himself in a situation in which he enjoyed only 5% approval amongst the Israeli public. How did that happen? It's most unusual for an American president to have less than 75-80% approval from Israelis because they understand how critically important the United States is to Israel's survival and well-being. Bill Clinton was always around 85% approval rating. George Bush was somewhere up there too. That was part of the problem. You see, Clinton and Bush had poured affection on Israelis, and Israelis love to be loved. They're very insecure people, not surprisingly, given their history. And Barack Obama is not exactly a lovey-dovey guy. He's Mr. Cool. So this was something the Israelis were not used to. 16 years they'd been showered with affection. But that wasn't the real problem. This great speech that Obama gave in Cairo had two problems to Israeli ears. And I'm talking not about the right wing in Israel. I'm talking about across the political spectrum in Israel. The first problem was that he gave the impression to the Israelis that he was distancing the United States from Israel in order to curry favor in the Arab and Muslim worlds. And that was a problem for them. They felt like what they were no longer the cherished wife, that Obama had gone off chasing the other woman. And beyond that, what Obama said in the speech about Israel's reason for being was a narrative that wasn't Israel's narrative. Israel's narrative, as I think probably most of you know, is how Israel was recreated in the ancient homeland of the Jews, the land that God gave to the Jews. And Obama didn't mention that. What Obama bought into was what the Israelis understand is the Arab narrative, that the justification for Israel's existence was because of the Holocaust. Of course, the Arabs say, well, why the hell should we pay the price for something that Europe did to the Jews? So it went over very badly in Israel. And that's the reason why his standing in Israel dropped dramatically. It wasn't because he demanded a settlements freeze, including natural growth. Settlements are not a consensus issue in Israel, by any means. I think it's a majority of Israelis really question the whole settlement enterprise. So it wasn't about that. It was these other things that gave the Israelis the impression that he didn't love them. And the fact that he went to Ankara and he went to Riyadh and he went to Cairo and he never came to Jerusalem just was taken as clear evidence of this case. Bill Clinton didn't turn up in Jerusalem until well into his second year in office. But that didn't register with Israelis in these circumstances. So on the one hand, we got Abu Mazen sitting up in a high tree and we had no good way of getting him down. And on the other hand, we lost the means of influencing Netanyahu. You see, Netanyahu's experience with Clinton was that he mishandled his relationship with him. And as a consequence, when his government coalition collapsed, he lost his re-election bid because he was seen to have mishandled his relationship with the United States and with a popular president. And Netanyahu, the second time around, had learnt that lesson and was therefore feeling under pressure to accommodate Obama's demands. But Bibi reads the polls. And when he saw Obama's popularity dropping and his going up, suddenly he didn't face the same kind of dilemma. It was much easier now for him to maintain the support of his right wing by saying no to the President of the United States because it didn't cost him in terms of Israeli public opinion, given the unpopularity of the American president. And therefore, we essentially ended up in a circumstance in which we were making no progress on our efforts on either front. Palestinians wouldn't sit down and negotiate, the Israelis wouldn't freeze settlements, and the Arabs wouldn't come to the party. Then along came Goldstone. Goldstone, that's, of course, the report by Judge Goldstone about the conflict in Gaza that took place last January, in which he accuses both Hamas and Israel of war crimes and suggests that if Israel doesn't investigate, have an independent investigation, it should be referred to the Security Council and then to the International Criminal Court. Netanyahu says, hey, you know, if the Palestinians are going to pursue this effort to try us in a criminal court, we're not going to negotiate. And so you, Mr. Obama, have to get the Palestinians to stop doing this, which President Obama and Secretary Clinton then went to Abu Mazen and said, you've got to stop this if you want negotiations. Abu Mazen said, okay. And then, as you know, there was this huge reaction amongst the Palestinians. How could Abu Mazen betray them like that? And so he changed his mind. At that moment, we had to anticipate the consequences of what we did. We had to have some kind of package. If Abu Mazen was going to do this, there had to be some kind of protection for him. There had to be some kind of way that he could say to the Palestinians, look, that's not a productive way to go. Negotiations, settlements freeze, prisoner release, so on. Here's what we can achieve. But in the circumstance, since we didn't anticipate it, we didn't put together the package, and when we turned to Netanyahu to try to get him to do it after Abu Mazen had changed his mind, Netanyahu said no. So he managed to observe the Hippocratic Oath in the breach. We managed to do harm. Harm to Abu Mazen's standing, harm to our own credibility, which was only made worse when the Secretary of State used this word unprecedented in describing what Israel was prepared to do on the settlement front. So what is to be done? Well, some people say, like Tom Friedman, the best thing for the United States to do now is to unlearn that first lesson about trying and simply walk away. Make it clear to the Arabs and Israelis that we're not in a hurry. If they're not in a hurry, let them stew in their own juices and call us when they're ready. That would be, in my view, highly irresponsible. Left to their own devices, the parties will do only one thing. They'll have at it again. Very hard, on the other hand, to try to achieve negotiations given the circumstances I've just described. The critical point, and I'll conclude on this note, is to look for the sense of urgency, because that's where the breakthrough will come. And there actually is a sense of urgency out there. Where is it? The Prime Minister of the Palestinian Authority, Salam Fayyad, is determined to build the state of Palestine from the ground up with responsible, capable security force and transparent, responsible, accountable institutions of governance. And he's making considerable progress in the West Bank. But he needs something positive to point to beyond the improvement of the economy if he's going to be able to continue along this path. He has a sense of urgency about that, especially because the negotiations aren't going anywhere and he doesn't have a political cover. On the other side, Bibi Netanyahu, believe it or not, is suddenly feeling the heat. Why? Because he can't stop the Goldstone process with nothing. He needs a negotiation to be able to show that there's an alternative to this effort to take Israel to the criminal court. And his security advisors are telling him the problem at the moment is not Iran. The problem is the Palestinians. And if you don't move now into a negotiation, we will find ourselves in a much more difficult situation. So I believe that he too has a sense of urgency. And we're not going to be able to get them into negotiations, but I believe we could get the Israeli army to withdraw from the A and B areas, have the Palestinian security forces take control there, and then talk about another step, which would be for the Israeli army to hand over control in those parts of the West Bank that were never ceded to the Palestinians, that would give Salam Fayyad an ability to show that he's making progress on the ground in terms of establishing a Palestinian state in territory that would be under Palestinian control, and in that way to show that there is an effective way to liberate Palestine while we wait for the circumstances to change again and negotiations to start. So it's not a great solution, but it's very important when you try that you also succeed rather than fail. And having failed once, we need very much now for America's credibility in peacemaking to find a way that can succeed. And that is, I believe, the way to do it. Thank you very much. I think we have some time for some questions. If you'd like to ask them, it would be useful to me if you could come up to the microphone so everybody can hear you and identify yourself and make sure there's a question at the question mark at the end of your question. Yes, please.
You mentioned that President Obama, although he gets an E for effort, has been thus far not successful. But do you think that his effort is what earned him the Nobel Peace Prize? And do you think that it was well earned?
Well, the Nobel Peace Committee did not say that he was getting the prize for making peace in the Middle East. They said something to the effect of, you know, he's changed the nature of doing business in the world and the way in which the United States is engaging with the world. And that's what he was awarded the prize for. He himself said that it was premature. But no doubt that having gotten the prize, it will increase the pressure on him to try to deliver, particularly when it comes to peacemaking in the Middle East, which is like the, you know, the holy grail of peacemaking efforts. Yes, please.
Thank you for such an interesting analysis. I didn't quite follow was it seemed like all the issues in terms of not having peace in the Middle East seemed to sit squarely on settlements and the Israeli actions, and I didn't hear anything at all about anything the Palestinians have or have not been doing all this time. We've been down this path before. Israel's been out of areas A and B. We got rewarded with terrorism and an uprising for that. In Gaza, Israel withdrew and was rewarded with rockets, after which we had to go back into Gaza, for which we've been rewarded with the Goldstone Report, which accuses Israel instead of recognizing how this all came about. So I was wondering if you might fill us in on that side of it.
Yeah. Well, the reason that you don't hear a lot of talk about Palestinians needing to live up to their responsibilities is that the Palestinian Authority actually is doing what it has been required to do. That is to say that it is now fighting terrorism in the West Bank. It is now dismantling the infrastructure of terror. It is now cooperating with the Israeli army, and it is now gaining high marks from the Israeli army for what it's doing, and it's the Israeli army that is now talking about pulling out of the A and B areas because the Palestinians are assuming the responsibilities that they're required to do. Now, it's not perfect. You know, they're also required to stop incitement, and while they've taken some steps in that regard, there is still incitement going on. But it's a dramatic improvement in the West Bank over anything that we've seen from the Palestinians since the Intifada broke out. They have retrained with American and Jordanian help their security forces. They have deployed them and established order in all of the main West Bank cities and towns. And they have fought and died in battles with Hamas in order to establish control. That's why you don't hear about it, is because there's not a lot that we can complain about in terms of what they're doing in the security realm in terms of the responsibilities that they have. Why we hear a lot about settlements is partly because Obama put it out there, but also because Israel undertook an obligation to freeze settlements, including natural growth. That's their part of phase one of the roadmap. They also undertook the obligation to dismantle settlement outposts. And Ariel Sharon and Ehud Olmert, both prime ministers, promised George Bush that they would do that. They haven't done that. So that's why there is a greater focus today on settlement activity than there is on the Palestinian Authority undertaking its responsibilities. In the case of Gaza, it's of course a different situation. The Palestinian Authority was kicked out of Gaza in a military putsch by Hamas. And so there you've got a very different situation. Hamas has never accepted the roadmap, doesn't accept Israel, doesn't accept the peace process, doesn't accept that it has to give up violence or terrorism. And so you're dealing with a very, very different challenge there. They're not part of the peace process. And so that's why what happens in Gaza is not, has to be dealt with in other ways, which is what Israel has done. Yes, please.
Sir, you said that the reputation of the U.S. was tarnished by how we fought the war in Iraq. was wondering if you could expand on that with particulars, and is there a way that we could have done that that would not have tarnished our reputation?
Well, I actually supported the war in Iraq because I thought that it was important to get rid of Saddam Hussein, who was a psychopath inflicting great damage on the Iraqi people. But the way that we went about it, and I'm happy to revisit all of the details, but the essence of it was going in there with insufficient forces, dismantling the Iraqi army rather than reassembling it. And then going after all levels of the Ba'ath Party, which was the essential elements of the governance of the country, produced a kind of a chaos that then became a perfect place for Al-Qaeda to build its capabilities to attack us and to start a sectarian war. And in the process, tens of thousands of Iraqis died. I don't think we really know how many died in the process. And our credibility was much affected by that. When we first went in and toppled Saddam Hussein, the Iranians, Hezbollah, Hamas, all lowered their profile, stopped their activities, became very concerned about what the United States might do. Syria started cooperating with us. The Iranians sent us a message saying they were ready to do a deal with us. But as soon as we stumbled, as soon as it became clear that we were getting bogged down in this sectarian conflict, they all started taking advantage of that, including the Iranians going in and supporting the Shia in attacking us, killing our soldiers. So that's what I'm referring to. We could have done it in a different way. We should have done it in a different way. And I think the results would have been better as a result. Yes, please.
Do the political leaders in Israel and perhaps the military leadership have confidence in the American ability and the American coalition ability to prevent Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons? And I presume you will say no, but then what do you think Israel will do to prevent Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons?
Well, the Israelis at the moment are actually working very closely with the Obama administration and dealing with Iran's nuclear program. And they seem to be quite confident that this approach of engaging the Iranians, testing their intentions, seeing if they will ship out the fuel that they have already enriched, that either that approach will work, which is a long shot, I think, or it will reveal to the world what Iran's true intentions are. After all, if all it wants is nuclear fuel for civilian purposes, then there is a way for them to have that. And so the whole effort at the moment, with the spotlight on Iran's clandestine activities, the revelation of its clandestine enrichment facility in Qom, all of that is designed, in effect, to put the Iranians in a situation in which they will have to decide, are they willing to accept an arrangement that will enable them to have the fuel they say they need for civilian nuclear purposes, but will not have the ability to build a nuclear bomb, or not? If the answer is no, then the Israelis are fairly confident that there will be sufficient support, including with the Russians, to go back to the Security Council and and get harsh sanctions implemented. And then we'll have to see what happens. From their point of view, as I read it, and I just came back from Israel last week, they have some more breathing space at this point. And you do not hear them now talking about military action. If the sanctions don't work, and if the regime in Iran manages to continue with its efforts to enrich uranium and suppress the opposition at home, then I think eventually you get to a fork in the road where the choice will be between military action or pursuing a policy of deterrence and containment of Iran, the kind of policy that the United States has applied to other nuclear proliferators. And I can't, it's very hard to predict what exactly the circumstances will be at that moment when we reach that fork in the road, if we reach it. I think it's fair to say that Israel will prefer to take the path of military action, and the United States will prefer to take the path of containment and deterrence, because we got 2,000 nukes, we can deter anybody. For Israel, it's a much more dicey proposition. One nuclear bomb on Israel, it'll destroy Israel and the Palestinians. So for them, it's much harder to tolerate than it is for the United States. But at the moment, we're not facing that situation. And at the moment, the United States and Israel are working very closely together to deal with what they both perceive as a common threat, and they have a common strategy for dealing with it. So all of this concern about Israel going off and bombing nuclear facilities is, I think, misplaced for the time being. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We've heard the inaugural lecture in the Phil and Ruth Sokoloff Lecture Series, co-sponsored by the UNO College of Arts and Sciences and the Jewish Federation of Omaha. The guest speaker was Martin Indyk, former United States Ambassador to Israel and Vice President and Director of the Brookings Institute. He spoke on the topic, The New Administration, Making Peace in the Middle East. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, November 24th, 2009, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Wendy Townley, Assistant Director for Media Relations at UNO, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.